Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Good morning, I'm Eddie Mayfield. This is Driven to Business. Glad you're here. Hey, have you ever sort of found yourself sort of languishing for older times, like wishing, you know, back in the 70s we did it this way and this is how business was, or back in the 90s, depending on your age, or even back in the early part of the 2000s. And you know, somehow that was a better time, and you sort of are wondering when we're going to get back to that. You know, I always tell people when they start talking to me like that, that you really should think of today as normal. In other words, this is the new normal, but it's normal. The business climate we're in now is the business climate we're in. And if you're going to be profitable in business, you must profit in the climate that we're in right now. Looking back at things with nostalgia can be a little bit misleading. My wife and I recently drove past my grandmother's house over in a suburb of Birmingham, Alabama. And when I was a kid, I always thought that house was so large, and I thought the yard was so large, and it was a ditch in the front that my cousins and I used to wrestle in. I thought that was a huge ditch. And when you drive by and look at that now, it's a very small house. It's a very small yard. The ditch is hardly even a ditch. But as a kid, you just have these memories. And we can all be that way about anything, including about business. We can look back and sort of be blinded and sort of wear rose-colored glasses of nostalgia when we look back at things, instead of dealing with the reality of where things are now and the opportunities as they exist. You know, business opportunities always exist. During the depths of the Great Depression, where many Americans suffered, there were people that became quite wealthy during those times. But I think we all tend to look at today's times, if we're not very careful, and we're a little pessimistic. We don't see the opportunities. I want to read you a few statements here and talk about them a little bit. This is from an article out of a Reliable Plant magazine, and there's just some statements here. I want to read them to you. Listen to this. Everything that can be invented has been invented. That was said by a guy named Charles Duell, who was the director of the United States Patent Office in 1899. He said that in 1899, everything that could be invented had been invented. Think of that. Listen to this. Sensible and responsible women do not want to vote. That was what Grover Cleveland said in 1905. Get this. There is no likelihood man can ever tap the power of the atom. A guy named Robert Milham, who was the Nobel Prize winner in physics, said that in 1923. I find this one amusing. The horse is here today, but the automobile is only a novelty, a fad. That was the president of the Michigan Savings Bank advising people against investing in the Ford Motor Company. I remember when I was in the Coast Guard, attending an electronic school, we had an old chief in there who was very good at what he did. But I remember he pulled me aside and said, look, Mayfield, this solid state stuff here is not here to stay. This was in the late 60s. So this solid state stuff is not here to stay. Just learn tubes. He said, that's where the future is, son, is in tubes. Well, he was wrong, as were a lot of people that thought that. Listen to this. Video won't be able to hold on to any market it captures after 6 months. People will get tired of staring at a plywood box every night. The guy that said it was Daryl F. Zanuck, who's a 20th century Fox. And he was commenting on television in 1946. You know, when television first came out, people thought there's no way anybody's going to want to watch a little small box in their house that has no future at all. And listen to this one. What use could any company make of an electric toy? That was Western Union said that when they turned down the rights to the telephone in 1878. You know, any of us, we sort of laugh at those things, the people that said things that in hindsight, looking back, were just silly statements. Like, you know, everything that can be invented has been invented. But yeah, we do tend to sometimes pull into ourselves around business and say, well, you know, all the opportunities in business have been taken. You know, we're having to either copy somebody and sort of pick the crumbs up, or we just resign ourselves to mediocrity. The idea there's nothing coming along that we can really excel in and change the culture and change the world with. But that is such a false way to look at things. You know, businesses today, any business, whether you're a large business or a small business, you're experiencing change at a rate that was unknown in past years, absolutely unknown. I looked this up right before coming in here to go on the air. The 85% roughly of American households own a computer. They have a computer in there. I'm surprised it's not higher, frankly. But 85% of American households own computers. When I started my business career, in the business that I'm in now, in the late 70s, almost no one owned a computer. I was a relatively tech-savvy person, but we didn't have a computer. In fact, after working there a little while, we ended up with what we used to call word processors, if you can remember that. That was sort of computers you could just type on, and you could store limited amounts you could type a form letter and sort of store the letter on there. We then moved to what was called mainframe computers, where you were using what we now call dumb terminals. Basically, you had a keyboard and a black and white screen to type on, and it was sometime later before PCs actually came to be. And if you read Bill Gates's book of many years ago, The Way Ahead, he called some of it right, he called some of it wrong. He said that personal computers will not become popular until some killer app comes along, and he gave several ideas what he thought that might be. They were all wrong. I think the killer app that really pushed computers into the mainframe was when people began catching on to the idea of email. Something that really, if you stop and think about it, if you'd back in my granddad's day, if you'd mentioned to him people were going to use email in the first place, he would have asked you what that was. In the second place, he would want to know why you would ever want to do that when you pick up a telephone and call somebody or write him a note and hand it to him. Why would you want to do that? Well, again, that's looking at things in today's light. Instead of looking at changes and sort of embracing them, it doesn't mean every change is good. Every change is certainly not good. There are about three types of ways that businesses implement change. Here's the first way. The business absolutely bottoms out from not changing. And you're forced into it by the fact that that's your choice to either change or go out of business. And that change could mean laying off half your people if you've got multiple offices, getting rid of all the other offices and just basically pulling in your horns, circling the troops, circling the wagons, and sort of just going into survival mode. And you're forced into that change by a changing market you did not see coming. And a lot of people don't make it through out of that. A lot of people don't survive that. It's more common than you might think, and particularly people in technology businesses. Businesses of technology can absolutely change so quick it can catch your breath. And it doesn't mean you have to be this absolute guru that stays on top of everything, but it does mean you need to pay attention to it. I'm going to give some examples in a minute in a political way of how you, even looking at political things around you, can take a look and perhaps figure ways to make money and do business with it. The second type of organizational change people do is changing just enough to maintain the status quo. It's kind of a chicken's web change. Okay, we see the market's changing, and we're going to have to adjust ourselves a little bit here, but we're not going to go crazy with it. So we just adjust enough to maintain the status quo. The problem, though, any of you in business that have given any thought to this whatsoever, that just the act of maintaining a status quo is very, very, very difficult. Most businesses are either growing or they're declining. In fact, that's true of most organizations, whether you're talking about a charity or a church or a small business. You're either improving and getting a little bigger, or you're shrinking. It's very hard to stand to keep that seesaw balance and stand right in the middle. And the reason for it, we've covered on the program here before, the reason is if you're a company that's not going to grow, you're going to attract a certain kind of people, and you're going to run off a certain kind of people. And it just happens to be the people you're going to attract are not the people that are really probably going to help you make a success out of that business. And the people you're going to run off are the people that will. So part of it is just that simple. But also, they're just a dynamic. There's nothing, what's energetic? How does anybody get energized to let's just stay where we are? No one's ever energized with that. There's no adventure in that. There's no challenge to that. That takes no energy. There's no vision in that. And consequently, you tend to surround yourselves with people who have no vision. And perhaps you even teach yourself to have none. And, as it says in the Bible, there's no vision, people perish. That's the second type, people that just maintain. And the third type of organization are people that absolutely do embrace change and create a culture of change. This doesn't mean they change for the sake of change. That's a mistake, too. And we've talked to him before. Changing too rapidly is a mistake. It's got to be managed and taken care of. I love a saying by Jack Welch that I've heard him say, the former CEO of General Electric. He says that I'm convinced that if the rate of change inside of an organization is less than the rate of the change outside, the end of that organization is in sight. Let me say it again. He said if the rate of change inside your organization is less than the rate of change in your market, then the end of your organization is in sight, because you've got to, that's the rate of change you have to make, is the rate of change that's taking place in your market. And sometimes it's a little bit hard to see that. And, you know, sometimes even large companies don't possess any kind of an innate skill for making that happen. It's kind of a painful type of an absurd. Let me ask a couple of questions, and we'll continue these after the break. But this is something to ask yourself, perhaps. What are the early warning signs in your industry? What would they be that a change is inevitable? You know, I can tell you one that comes to mind to me immediately is when it became apparent, and it was not intuitive to us, but became apparent to many of us, that where the computer industry was going was that software was going to cost more than hardware. Now, that was a hard pill to swallow for many of us who were hardware-oriented. It's like, how is it possible that this software you can't smell, touch, or feel is worth more money than this collection of transistors and microcircuits that you've got in front of you here, and you know, with a cooling fan and where you put power to it and all that? But we all know that's what happened, and that's probably true with every one of you now, is that the software inside your computer probably costs more than your computer cost over time. That may not be true at first, but as you begin to add programs to your computer, that's what's going to happen. And that's a change that a lot of people did not see coming. Well, you need to ask yourself about that. Where are changes in my industry like that that's inevitable? Where's it going? And how do I adapt to it? Not only adapt to it, but how do I profit from it? You're listening to Driven to Business. By the way, streaming live on biz1190.com, podcast on eddiemayfield.com, and on iTunes. See you in a minute. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. We're close to the last segment by asking a question that perhaps will help you to prepare for change, and it would be this. What are the early warning signs in your industry that a major change is inevitable? What would you look around? And that's a question that's different for every industry, but it's a question you should ask of yours. What is it? Here's another question. What systems and structures could you put in place to maintain a competitive advantage over your competitors and avoid being blindsided by the changes that are coming? Here's another one. How can you understand the thinking of demographic groups not represented in your organization? And that may well be that you're perhaps serving a demographic or something that is not in your organization. So how do you know how they think? You know, I'm not going to name any names here because I don't want to get in trouble with it, but by doing business all over the country and a little bit worldwide, we've had to deal with some cultures that we didn't really understand. And we've got a little bit blindsided occasionally by some of that when you will say something and you can't understand why would you think this. And you know, I can recall we have a vendor that's from a country in Asia, and some of their policies and their way of thinking on policies makes no sense to us at all. And they'll tell us something and we're just flabbergasted. Like, why would you think we would do that? And again, it has to do with the fact that, and we've discussed this with a couple of people of that background that are not in our company, and they explained to us that they're thinking, well, you may run into that in your company. Perhaps there's just thinking. It's not that they're worse than you or dumber than you or anything like that. It's just that it's a different way of thinking. And perhaps if you're going to do business with them, well, then it would help you to understand the way that they think. Here's a great question. If you were your own competitor, if you were your own competitor, what would you do to take business away from yourself? Think about that a minute. If you were your own competitor, what would you do to take business away from yourself? You know, if you think of that and put a little thought power into that, that could lead you to making some really significant changes and positive changes in your company that will actually make it very hard for another smart competitor like you to come along and take the business. Are there customer requests you get now that seem outrageous? We get them sometimes, and we think they're outrageous. But, you know, occasionally it helps to back up and say, okay, it seems outrageous to me, but is that a trend in the industry? Is that what they're looking for now? And if that's so, how do I meet that challenge? Those are the kind of questions you should look at, even though they're not comfortable to look at, perhaps. Now, the conclusion may be that is, in fact, an outrageous request, and we can't do that. No one can do that. Okay, fine. Just put some thought into that. And another one is, what technologies... This is hard too. What technologies have recently come about that could threaten your business? I've used the example here before of the slide rule company that had done a customer survey to see how well they were liked by their customers, and they were very well liked by their customers, and so they thought they had a secure future. What they did not see was that the electronic calculator had been invented, and they really had no future. But you know, when we can all kind of fall into those traps. What's changing out there that's absolutely going to kill the way you're doing business? We've seen a little bit of this at my company, EMA, with the declining cost of electronic motor drives. The declining cost of electronics in general. You know, when I was younger, I used to work part-time at a place. I worked doing two things. I used to repair television sets for people. That's hard to make a living doing that anymore. And get this, I used to repair CB radios way back in. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine anybody taking a CB radio in to be repaired today? I used to know a guy that repaired VCRs. How'd you like to be in that business right now? Repairing VCRs. What kind of future you think's in that? Let me tell you, none. And those are the kinds of things, if you are set up to do those kind of repairs, if that's your business and it's a declining market, what you really need to do, you don't have to throw your business that you've got right now out the window, but realize that's going down and start looking at what else can you do? What other skills that you employ to do that, what else could they do? And begin to look at that. You know, the idea that we're all affected by changes in information technology. I mean, it offers both great opportunities for us and incredible risks for many of us. A small company these days, one of the things I really do like about the idea of the internet, you know, a small company, the playing field has been very, very, very leveled in many ways by the internet. Small companies can compete all around the world now with multinational companies, and you see that all the time. We do it. Others do it as well. So, again, that's both a challenge for change to learn how to embrace it and deal with it, but also it's enormous opportunities, and you can look at that two ways. The other thing is... you know, we've seen this, and other companies see it too. You know, we have a different sort of an employee culture than we used to have in this country. When I was a younger guy, and I did this several times, when the company I worked for would ask me to move somewhere, I don't say with no thought. I did think about it, but generally speaking, I would move. I did that several times. We would move. You know, it's very, very, very difficult to get an employee to move these days. It's very difficult because employees, and I'm not even criticizing this, employees have different values about that. They value their life outside of work. They value and they put a high premium on that. And if you're going to ask somebody to move somewhere else, you're going to do some convincing there. And so those are the kinds of things that we have to deal with. What's also changed, and we've talked about this here and talked about it with many people, is the idea that customer expectations are very high, particularly as regards to information. They're less tolerant of mistakes from you, very less tolerant of mistakes, and they want they expect exceptional service. And as many of you that are in consumer-driven businesses know, if they don't get it, they will go on social media and tell everyone what a lousy restaurant or a lousy dry cleaner or a lousy whatever that you are. For the fact that they were not happy when they went there. You know, one of the things we do have to remind ourselves all the time is that we can all, no matter how large or small your organization is, your customers can fire you. They can absolutely fire you. Your customers can put you out of business. That's something you really need to understand. With no customer, there's no business. And so one thing is, how do I know what I should change? Well, one of the things we can do is ask the people to whom we most depend on, our customers. What are they expecting out of it? What would they like to see? And that's just by asking them, hey, how are we doing for you? How can we better meet your needs? What can we do better? And part of that, I think, is just meeting their needs and doing it in sort of responsible ways. I was thinking about this in terms of, I recently got a, I have an iPhone, a lot of you do, and you may have other things. I'm not pushing the iPhone over anything else. But, you know, one of the things that I find annoying about it is they push updates out at you. And whether you like it or not, they'll say, oh, you need to update so-and-so. And it's got a little better, I will say that. But in the past, it seemed to me every time I would update, things would quit working in there. Apps that I had purchased would not work anymore. And that's so frustrating and annoying. Why didn't you know the apps are on my phone here because you can look at my phone anytime you want to back there. Why are you giving me changes that make my app stop working? And then, you know, later on the app people will catch up with it. But that's such an annoying thing to force that out on people and just annoy them. Well, you know, don't be doing that in your company. Don't force changes out on your customers that they don't want. Now, maybe it's to a long-term benefit to have these updates on the iPhone. I wouldn't argue that. But, you know, they should sell it to you a little better if that's the deal. We need to anticipate the need for change, something we just need to learn how to do. I want to talk to you a minute, and we don't have much time to get into this before the break, but I subscribe to a newsletter put out by a guy called Stansberry Research. You can find it at stansberryresearch.com. I'm not advertising, I don't have anything to do with them, just saying it's a great investment advisory firm that I deal with. They publish a thing that I subscribe to called the Stansberry Investment Advisory, and it comes out monthly, and it's really one of the things I look forward to reading every month. And after the break, I'm going to read you a little thing they have in there about a change taking place in China. And it's going to come from an interesting perspective. It's going to start off very cultural and even a moral story, perhaps. But there's a business side to it that I want to share that with you after the break. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Back in just a minute. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Keep in mind, today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com and on iTunes. Check us out there. That's EddieMayfield. Did you like the milk? eddiemayfield.com. Go there and check us out. You can also contact me at eddie@eddiemayfield.com or through the website. My business site where I do my day job is emainc.net. Go there and check us out. I'll talk to you a minute about, I read a newsletter from a guy named Porter Stansberry who does a Stansberry Investment Advisor. The last one that I got in the November issue was an interesting article in there. And it starts off talking about, and you may have all seen this image, it begins to describe an image of a young lady, a 22-year-old young mother named Feng in China. And the picture is, it shows her lying twisted in a very small hospital bed. It's in China, obviously. Dark in there. She's got one arm like draped over her head and the other across her bed, and her eyes are obscured by her hair, but they're glossed over and staring into space, and it's kind of hard to know if she's alive or dead. But lying next to her is a naked, blood-stained baby, and there's no doubt that the baby's dead lying next to her. And her story is that her sister-in-law snapped that picture following 96 hours of sort of torture for this young mother, during which the Chinese government thugs hunted her down, abducted her, and poisoned her. And she's a mother of a five-year-old girl, and she had been one of the most wanted figures in her small rural county in China. And her crime was wanting to have a second child. She was pregnant, and this was under the one-child rule in China, where forced abortions happened if you did that. In May 30, 1972, the government official showed up at her home to enforce this, And they tried to convince her, she was 7 months pregnant, to have an abortion. She fought them off and told them no. And she basically left the house and went up to her aunt's. Well, she hid in a bedroom, and 16 kind of thug types showed up from the government. And they began to guard her and monitor her around the clock and threaten her. They finally ended up all being drunk, and for them being drunk, she sneaked out of the house and walked a little ways to another relative's house and hid out there. But 70 hours later, they mounted a big search for her, and they found her hiding under a bed and drug her out of there. Her husband was a number of miles away working at a remote mine site, and he got a text from several of the government officials offering to accept a bribe for the child's life. But the bribe was such a large sum, this is a very poor miner, it was impossible. So he basically made him a counteroffer, and they at first said yes, they would take that. But then they sent back and said no. They raised it back up to about midway between the first and the second offering there and said, and you've got to have it today. Well, he was a day's trip away from the village, so that was not possible. And so they ended up dragging this young lady to a hospital and kept her father-in-law out of the room and injected her with poison. The baby was then delivered, stillborn. And then, as is their custom, they basically stuck the dead baby on the mother's bed and left. Now, what happened, though, was her sister uploaded this picture that she took completely illegally onto a Chinese social media site over there, against the law to do this. And there was a huge outcry all over China about this. Such an outcry that the communist government couldn't control it. And as a result of that, they ended up stopping this policy, which stopped recently. This one-child policy in China has been reversed, as many of you probably know. You know, the reason they did this, and this is a great point, the reason they put this into effect anyway was when the communists took over, they at first encouraged large families. They also encouraged these families to move off the farms and into the city to be laborers in plants. Well, what happened as a result of that, by not having any farmers, a great famine happened in China, and over 30 million people died from the famine. So, again, this is such a typical thing that a government creates a problem, and their solution creates another problem, and then they have another solution that creates even a worse problem. So after the famine, well, that's when it came down with this one-child rule. Here the idea was, okay, we got a famine, too many mouths to feed, so let's make less mouths. Let's have less mouths to feed. And that began their deal. Now, what they didn't look at was long-term, what the cost was going to be to the country of aborting a whole generation of workers, because the problem China has now, they have such an aging population. They're not able to maintain their economy. You know, all the stuff we hear about the Chinese economy and how great it is, I saw this. This, to me, was brought home by a panel I saw, and they were talking about the Chinese economy and how strong it was, and they were sort of like downing the American economy and saying how strong it was. Well, the moderator of the panel finally said, and these are all Americans in there talking, how many of you would move to China? They all said no. You know, which tells you all you want to know about how great the Chinese economy actually is. Their quality of life there is terrible compared to here. Well, the reason this was made into sort of the reason Stansberry put this in front of a business, I think in the first place, is very well written, and it's a great moral outrage type piece in the front of it. But he's making the point that, and I'm not downplaying at all the horror of the abortion there in China, but what he's saying is, the result of those atrocious, stupid policies by the Chinese government has been a shortage of workers. Now that they have lifted that ban, there's also going to be another. There's going to be an incredible baby boom starting in China. And for any entrepreneurs, baby booms create opportunities, just like they did here in our country when the baby boomer generation, of which I'm part, began here in our country. So that's a way to look at it. I want to give you one other quick example. I don't mean to make today's program all political, but this is another thing I want to talk to you about today because it kind of hits close to me. I've been to, going to third world countries and been to Africa a couple of times, and we've been to Africa once and been to several other third world countries. But, you know, one of the major killers in those countries is malaria. And the sad thing about that is malaria was almost eradicated from the face of the earth. In fact, prior to in about the mid-20th century, by some estimates, about one half of the world's population, of everyone that ever lived on the earth, had died from complications of malaria. So malaria was a very serious disease. It was a serious disease here in the United States. The pioneers and early people in America faced great problems from malaria around here. But you know, and when World War II began, the world was essentially powerless against this disease. Malaria is a disease that's transmitted from one person to another by a particular type of mosquito. And in 1939, everything changed. A Swiss scientist named Paul Mueller, he developed a chemical that we call DDT. And DDT had an incredible effect on malaria. In fact, DDT, when it began to be used in some of these countries, and what DDT did was kill the mosquito that carried the malaria virus. And not only that, during World War II, our army issued used DDT to treat the areas of our soldiers to kill other lice and other vermin that carried bubonic plague, among other things, and it protected millions and millions of Allied workers back then. And you know, by 1948, after doing that, the country of Italy is one country that had had horrible problems with malaria. Italy, by engaging in an aggressive DDT program, by 1948, there wasn't a single case of malaria in all of Italy. And one of the most hard-hit areas from malaria had been India, where just been millions of people die. The entire nation, malaria cases fell from 75 million in the early 50s down to about 50,000. It's an incredible deal. But then the U.S. government got involved, and it got involved under pressure from some environmental groups. And they began to say that there was suspicion that DDT caused cancer in humans and caused eggs not to hatch in populations and other things that they thought were going on. And all these celebrities sort of jumped on the bandwagon and began to pressure the government, most particularly the EPA at that time, to do something about malaria. Well, when the EPA began looking, the EPA held hearings on it, and extensive hearings, and what they found out, there was not a shred of evidence to back up those charges. Now, it was very popular to believe it, but not a shred of evidence. So the EPA judge ruled against it. However, the EPA administrator, a guy whose name escapes me at the moment here, but I've seen it a number of times, who had been an attorney for the Environmental Defense Fund, a real left-winger, he overruled that, in effect banned DDT in the United States. And the United States then began to pressure the World Health Organization, other organizations, and world banks and other things to stop financing any kind of DDT spreading in these other countries. And as a result of that, malaria made a huge comeback in the third world. And since its banning, there's been about 50 million children die from malaria as a result of those policies. Now again, I just pointed out to say that, you know, when those of us that are in business say we're not anti-government, but we don't want government making ham-handed decisions which create problems and then make even worse decisions to solve the problem. Now back to the China situation there. What Stansberry had said, looking at he did this with an eye toward business, and I'll pull out of the moral side of it and just take that respect. He did it with an eye toward business. The idea that there's a baby boom in China represents a huge amount of business for a lot of people that we can do that. Now, entrepreneurs have always looked at the world around them and seen opportunities, always. And thank goodness for that, because we have a lot of products and a lot of services that are presented to us every day now that would not have been there had not some sharp people looked out at the landscape around them and said, hey, you know, why isn't there a better way of doing this? Or, you know, instead of letting this be a problem, let's let this be an opportunity. That's what entrepreneurs do. So I enjoy talking with, about, and about entrepreneurs. This is Eddie Mayfield. You're listening to Driven to Business. Be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Glad you're here. By the way, today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. Just go there, click on the podcast on the right-hand side, and you'll get it. And also, there's podcasts of our other programs there, and it will also be on iTunes probably next week sometime, so grab it there. Hey, we're talking about, in a general sense, we're wandering around a little bit here, but we're generally talking about the idea of change, viewing change as an opportunity, even some change as I had gone through that rather horrible story about the forced abortions in China and the horrible moral depravity that would push such a policy as that to have forced abortions. But even that they've lifted it, there now presents a business opportunity for entrepreneurs. And I said right going into the break that entrepreneurs, one thing they do is look at the landscape a little differently than other people. I've got a good friend, Larry, that was driving down the road here in North Georgia one time, and he saw a bunch of mobile homes, a bunch of abandoned trailers out in a field, just kind of parked out in the pasture. And he drove on past, but then here's the difference in him and the rest of us. He stopped the car and thought, what are those doing there? So he backs up and goes out there, climbs over the fence, goes up there and starts looking at them. Well, they're in pretty good shape. So he makes some inquiries. Who owns these things? Well, it turned out they were owned by some guy that had bought them surplus. I think they were going to be used for some kind of storm relief or something, but they were never used, as it turns out. The government often does things like this, buy things and, you know, waste money. And they're sitting out in the field basically rotting. So he asked the guy, what do you take for them? So he worked out a deal with the guy. Well, he took them and put them in a mobile home park, began renting them out, and has had a rental income from those for a long time. And you may think, well, who would want to rent out mobile homes? Well, you know, there are people that's what they live in, and they're fine, and you can make a living doing things like that. Now, he doesn't make his full living at that, but again, the idea is this is what an entrepreneur does. You look at things sitting out in the field somewhere and go, hey, there's a way to make some money off that, and so you get it back, you pull it back in. The company that I worked for in Texas a number of years ago, when the oil boom, in the early 80s, when the oil prices collapsed out there. And, you know, they're collapsed. Oil prices are down a little bit now, but they went down much, 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 much lower in the early 80s. It went down to $8 a barrel for one time, if you can imagine it. Down to $8 a barrel. And they just literally collapsed the economies out there in Houston, Texas, and some areas. And many, many, many people went out of business. There were savings and loans that went out of business. All sort of the housing market collapsed here in Texas. It really just floored it. And when everybody else was running out and sort of running for cover, the two guys that I worked for out there, they went around buying up drilling rig equipment. Now, you couldn't give a drilling rig away back in those days. The banks had foreclosed them, and they were getting them from the banks for literally pennies on the dollar. But their idea was, you know, eventually people are going to need oil again. people are driving cars, are heating their houses, they're you know, whatever. They're going to need oil at some point. And they had the cash, and they were in a position to do that. So they basically bought all this stuff, sat on it a while, and when the economy came back, made a lot of money on selling, on having it in hand and having it ready to go and ready to deliver, and therefore made a lot of money off pulling it back. Again, entrepreneurs look at things differently than other people, and so part of that is just paying attention to your landscape and thinking outside yourself a little bit as to how those kinds of things might happen. You know, one of the even in bad times, recessions, even depression. You know, during the Depression, there were people that got rich during the Depression. CNN had an article about this, and I'm just reading through this right quickly for you. Some people that got really rich during the Great Depression. One of them was Babe Ruth. The Sultan of SWAT. He made a lot of money during the Depression. In fact, he made most of his money during the Depression, and you can make out of that what you want to make out of it, but that's a fact. That's what he did. You know, another guy that made a lot of money during the Depression is not somebody we want to emulate necessarily. It was John Dillinger. John Dillinger made most of his money during the Great Depression. Don't endorse his methods or anything, but they managed to compile more than $3 million in today's money doing that. He was shot to death, by the way, by the FBI in 1934. There's a guy named Michael Cullen, who you may not know that name, but Cullen changed had changes that affect all of us today, because Cullen's guy came up with a modern supermarket where we buy groceries. Most of us today, we buy groceries in sort of the design that Cullen came up with. He's the guy that came up with the idea of having a parking lot in front of a store and having a wide variety, having refrigerated food in there, which, you know, the idea that people had just come up with refrigerators and all that. His motto was pile it high and sell it cheap. I don't know. I think maybe Walmart or somebody took that motto. I'm not sure, but that was his big motto back in those days. He was doing, within about 2 years of starting his business, he was doing about $75 million a year, which in today's dollars, which is really quite remarkable with a whole new idea there. You know, another guy that made a lot of money during the Great Depression, if you like old movies, James Cagney. Made a bunch of. In fact, he was such a force at one time that in order to get out of a contract that he had with Warner Brothers, he did several movies for free just to get out of the contract because he was worth so much money. Outside the contract, making a ton of money. There's a guy named Charles Darrow. It's a name you may not know, but every one of you, a few of you will not know what he came up with. Charles Darrow came up and invented the game Monopoly. He's the first, as far as we know, multimillionaire game designer because that game took off like crazy, and he made a lot of money. But just think of the idea: some guy sits down, I'm going to come up with and he spent a lot of time thinking about it. You know, Monopoly is a relatively complicated game. He spent a lot of time coming up with it, the idea of this is a way to make money. Have a game like this that people will buy and make money. And you know, the gaming industry today. Now, I'm not into the computer gaming. Some of you may be. Is a huge, huge business. In fact, if you can do that, if you have the ability to do that, you can make a good living at that. You can make a good living working for someone else. You can make a good living working for yourself. That is an interesting deal. J. Paul Getty. Getty made his money. He started off with a significant inheritance. He inherited $500,000, which back in the time he inherited that was a lot of money. Still a lot of money, but it was really a lot of money back then. But here's what entrepreneurs do. Instead of sitting on that, he took a big risk with it. This was another time when the oil industry had crashed. Oil stocks were at an all-time low, at least for that time. Getty went around and bought them up, spent his money, great risk, to buy them up. Well, when it came back, all of a sudden, he's a rival to Rockefeller, and that's why we know his name today was the fact that he took the risk to do that. Another guy was Howard Hughes, who kind of died a strange life. You know, he was died sort of as a nut. Sort of a crazy about bugs and things like all that kind of things. But, you know, he was quite an entrepreneur. He inherited a company from his dad. It was making good money. So he started off pretty high up the ladder to start with. But he also innovated. He started, he was a big innovator in the movie business. You know, right after the 1929 crash, it started the Great Depression, he made a movie called Hell's Angels. They cost $3.8 million, which may not be much by today's standards, but at the time that was made, that was the most expensive movie in the history of the earth, and no one had ever spent that kind of money. And he ended up making a lot of money. He also founded, right in the middle of that, he founded Hughes Aircraft Company at the height of the Depression, really. He founded Hughes Aircraft Company, and he built that company into a huge international defense supplier. And by the time he died, his fortune was around $2.5 billion. Joe Kennedy's another guy comes to mind. Joe Kennedy got rich during the Depression by doing a lot of speculation on stocks and so forth. And then when he finally got out of the stock market just before the crash, he invested in liquor, actually, and in movie studios and some other things and made a lot of money, sort of, no matter what you think about the Kennedys politically, he made quite a dynasty for himself by doing all that. Okay, how do we... wrap this up and get here's the bottom line on it. Opportunities exist everywhere. You know, when times are bad, people look for services they perhaps wouldn't look for otherwise. You know, if you're doing a selected type service for somebody, perhaps people will begin to maintain things rather than buy new ones. If you're in that kind of a business, you can look around and see what are people doing now. Are they keeping equipment longer? Well, there's an opportunity there for you to do that. And you can probably come up with many other things if you just sit down and think about it. You've been listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield here every week at 11 o'clock. See you next week.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.